Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Joe Hockey makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Mr. Hockey, as many of you know, has given a number of important addresses to us over the years, so it's great to have him back. I'll introduce him very briefly. He's been a Member of Parliament at North Sydney since 1996. He held very senior positions in government and in opposition, and now, of course, since the election of 2013 as Treasurer. And tonight, the Treasurer is going to speak for us on the topic of a budget for opportunity. Joe Hockey, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jared. Do you want a chair? I'm reluctant to give you a seat, given you live in my electorate. But well, ladies and gentlemen, there has been much written and said about the Abbott government's first budget. And praise for the budget has recognised that the structural reforms and the solutions to systemic deficits and growing debt help lift economic growth over time and put public finances on a sustainable footing. In fact, in just the last 48 hours, the head of the OECD has recognised that our economic action strategy is the right policy for the times. Criticism of our strategy has been political in nature and has drifted into 1970s class warfare lines, claiming the budget is unfair or that the rich don't contribute enough. The criticisms alleging budget inequality are not new. The gap between rich and poor has often been used to attack governments when all other avenues have been exhausted. But I would argue the comments about inequality in Australia are largely misguided, both from an historical perspective and from the perspective of the budget. Over two decades, uninterrupted economic growth has served us well. Australia has enjoyed an economic revolution. Official data shows average real household disposable income has gone from $540 per week in 1994 to over $820 per week now. That means the average Australian household is almost $290 per week better off today in real terms than they were nearly two decades ago. And this growth is broadly based across society. Household well-being across the community has grown significantly in the last two decades. And while much of the focus has been on the rich getting richer, the more accurate story is the fact that everyone is getting richer as a result of economic development. Few countries can tell this story. I admire Australians' egalitarian concern for fairness. We all want a society that protects the poor and strengthens the weak. The government is open to criticism and debate about our budget. However, we owe it to the community to set the facts straight and articulate the reasoning behind our decisions. Tonight, I want to address the claim head on that the budget is unfair and exacerbates inequality. This misguided cry is made on the claim that not everyone is asked to contribute equally, and that in the future some people will pay more for government services or receive less in payments. For example, concerns about the demise of universal healthcare or higher education accessibility are unfounded. They invoke mantras that reopen debates that were had and lost some 30 years ago. Universal healthcare has not been free to the consumer since I was born. In 1960, a 5-shilling co-payment was first brought in for the pharmaceutical benefits scheme. Higher education has not been free since Labor introduced fees in 1970. 1987. And I remember, as all of you know, I was there. Access to government services and payments has never been uniform across the community. The truth is, governments have never been able to achieve equality of outcomes. Some governments try, but they always fail. Only in a closed economy based on old-style socialism can a government hope to deliver uniform equality of outcomes. We have moved on. As a result, governments can only hope to provide equality of opportunity. Even then, as each day passes, forces such as power, personal empowerment and personal choice reduce our capacity to equalise opportunity. This should be welcomed and embraced because it reflects a strengthening of the power of individuals in the community rather than a centralisation of wisdom in government. For example, in recent time, disruptive forces like the internet and mobile telephony have transformed our communities. And of course, technology providers like Microsoft and Google have changed our access to and use of information. They and many other similar advances in society have changed the role of government in people's lives. Government does not have all the solutions. It cannot provide all the answers. So let us focus on what the government can do. That is, it can help get people to the starting line with a similar opportunity to succeed. But let us recognise that even then, governments are increasingly compromised in their ability to achieve equality of opportunity. Private demand is a powerful force for change. A good example of this is the determination of newfound Silicon Valley billionaires to step in to the United States school education system to train teachers in computer coding so that children as young as 8 years of age develop the skills for a future career. Some governments try to ignore the change, arguing they have neither the money nor the skills to change the curriculum at the behest of private sector demand. Other governments, like the Cameron government in the United Kingdom, recognise reality and deal with it. From September this year, they are making computer coding compulsory for students as young as 5 years of age. So we grew up thinking about English and maths as core subjects, but computer coding is now becoming a core subject because of the demand coming out of employers of tomorrow. I say this only to make the obvious point that the most difficult challenge for a society is to manage change. Government will never move as fast as a private citizen. So the starting point is to be realistic about what government can do. In our view, it is the responsibility of government to provide equality of opportunity with a fair and comprehensive support system for those who are most vulnerable. After that, it's up to individuals in the community to accept personal responsibility for their lives and their destiny. Our first budget is based on the premise that it is fair to expect those who have the capacity to pay should accept more personal responsibility for their cost of living, their cost of raising their children, their health services and their education services. It is nonsensical for government to continue to spend money at existing levels with the knowledge that this spending will not be sustainable and that in the years to come we will not be able to adequately assist those in genuine need. This is unfair to those who most need our help, and it's unfair to future generations who must pay the bill. It is unfair to keep a system intact that is clearly not encouraging participation and personal responsibility. Ladies and gentlemen, our welfare system is unsustainable in its current form, and it is not well targeted to those that really need our assistance. The federal government will spend $146 billion next year on welfare. That is 35% of the federal budget. We spend more on welfare than we spend on any other single policy area, including health, education, or defence. Payments are too broadly available to too many people. As a result, less is available to those most in need. At the moment, over half of Australian households receive a taxpayer-funded payment from the government. Over half of Australian households. According to the OECD Household Income Survey, Australians in the lowest 20% of income had the highest reliance on government for income of any country in the world. They have less private income and more government income than Germany, France, the Netherlands, Finland, Norway, or many other countries where government is much larger and the private sector much smaller as a percentage of the economy. This OECD survey illustrates that our income redistribution from taxpayers to tax receivers is more comprehensive and broader than any other country in the world. To put it in perspective, around 1 in 10 households rely entirely on the government for their household income. 13% of young Australians receive youth allowance. Over 70% of Australians over 65 receive the age or service pension. More than 1 in 20 working age Australians receive the disability support pension. So we have a very comprehensive welfare system. But it should not be taboo to question whether everyone is entitled to these payments. In my 2012 London speech, titled The End of the Age of Entitlement, I stated Australia was projected to spend around 16% of GDP on public social expenditure that year. Since then, these estimates have been revised upwards to spending of over 19% of the economy. 19%. We must recognise that this spending comes out of the pockets of someone else. Either it comes out of the pocket of today's taxpayers or the pocket of tomorrow's taxpayers who will repay this debt along with the interest bill. This year, the Australian Government will spend, on average, over $6,000 on welfare for every man, every woman and every child in the country. Given that only around 45% of the population pays income tax, the average taxpayer must pay more than twice this amount in tax to fund welfare expenditure. In other words, the average working Australian, be they a cleaner, a plumber or a teacher, is working over 1 month full-time each year just to pay for the welfare of another Australian. Is this fair? Whilst income tax is by far our largest form of revenue, just 10% of the population pays nearly two-thirds of all income tax. Just 10% of the population pays over two-thirds of all income tax. In fact, just 2% of taxpayers pay more than a quarter of all income tax. Maybe these taxpayers would argue that the tax system is already unfair. Company tax is our second largest source of revenue. Less than 1% of companies pay 62% of all company tax. In fact, just 12 companies pay over one-third of all company tax in Australia. These companies constantly argue that our tax system is unfair because our tax base is vulnerable to increasing global competition. With significant lower rates of company tax in the United Kingdom, which is 21%, Singapore 17%, or Hong Kong 16.5%, compared with our current rate of 30%. Our tax base is facing significant headwinds. That's why the Prime Minister promised at the last election to deliver a taxation white paper after widespread community consultation. So with a compromised taxation system, we must deal with the pressures on our spending programs, and they are growing. As I said before, Taxpayer entitlements must be focused on helping those most vulnerable rather than providing widespread access to the many at a massive cost to the few. Australians have shown they are prepared to contribute towards a social service where they see a direct benefit to themselves and their families. For example, in healthcare, just shy of 50% of the population pay for private health insurance with hospital cover. Contrary to common belief, this is not just a contribution by the wealthy. An astounding 5.6 million private insurance policyholders have a household income of less than $50,000 a year. 5.6 million have a household income of less than $50,000 a year. On top of this, taxpayers with an income over $20,000 pay more for their healthcare through the Medicare levy. Goes without saying that generally the higher the taxable income, the greater the amount of Medicare levy paid. As it stands, around 1 in 5 Australians already pay to see their doctor. For these patients, the average additional cost was $28.60 per visit, or around 4 times the proposed co-payment. Our universal healthcare system is certainly not free. Over and above Australians' individual contributions, Medicare costs the budget around $20 billion each year. Today, there are 263 million so-called free visits to healthcare professionals, including GPs. But in reality, taxpayers already pay a GP just over $36 for each of those standard consultations. The public-funded health system must be sustainable. If it becomes a second-class service, then that is unfair. With Medicare growing at 7% each year, fewer doctors will participate in the poorer, remunerated, free primary care system, and professionals will drift in larger numbers to the privately remunerated alternative system. This would mean over time that better quality healthcare would only be available for those who are able to contribute privately. That's why I welcome the statement from the Australian Medical Association that in principle they are not opposed to a co-payment. Our co-payment applies to all in society. When a 10-visit cap for concession card holders and children under the age of 16 applies. So as it stands today, some critics claim it's unfair to ask a pensioner to pay $7 each for the first 10 visits to the doctor. At the same time, those critics argue it is fair to have the very same pensioner pay $360 for their first 60 PBS medicine scripts from the very same doctor. So each year, a pensioner pays $6 for the first 60 scripts from a doctor, but they don't pay to go to the doctor. And under our proposal, it's somehow unfair to ask them to pay $7 for the first 10 visits and then free after that. By introducing a co-payment for Medicare, we are able to build a $20 billion medical research future fund that in the next decade will double medical research funding in Australia. This is fair. We must find new cures and treatments to make our health system sustainable and affordable into the future. Australia is making massive strides forward in medical research, but at times we are missing the financial scale that will lift us from a clever partner for offshore collaboration to a standalone initiator of life-changing medical breakthroughs. By contributing now through sensible savings in our health budget, every dollar of savings over the next 6 years goes into this medical research fund, which will change the lives of everyday Australians. And that's how we're going to make our health system more affordable. It will also potentially make us a global leader in medical research. Our universities are overwhelmingly government funded, but the only way they've been able to survive and grow is with international fee-paying students and increasing taxpayer support. The times have changed. Australian universities are no longer just competing against the likes of Oxford or Harvard although that certainly remains the case. They are competing against universities in our own region, like the Indonesian Universitas Terbuka, literally open university, that has over 500,000 students enrolled. New universities in China and India are emerging with similar large enrolments and significant balance sheets. Any university of this scale brings massive financial firepower and clout. Campuses with financial scale will, over time, attract the best academics in the world, and they will attract the best students in the world, including our own. It is also the case for too long we've been obsessed with equality of outcomes in education rather than equality of opportunity. Our reforms not only lift the capacity of our universities to be able to compete in the frenetic and intensely competitive global world of education, but they deliver equality of opportunity on a scale that has never previously been provided. Student loans will continue to be made available to students to ensure they don't have to pay a dollar up front for their education. Not a dollar. Making study more accessible to all, regardless of their socio-economic background. This is real and meaningful equality of opportunity. No student pays a dollar up front for university, which means there is equal access to a degree and a campus, notwithstanding your wealth or background. And most importantly, for the first time, universities will be required to direct $1 in every $5 of additional revenue raised towards a Commonwealth Scholarship Fund to support access for students from disadvantaged backgrounds. And they're missing out now. So the money, new money, is going into the biggest Commonwealth Scholarship Fund ever so that they don't miss out on a university education because Austudy or youth allowance is not enough to see them through. Fairness is the key to our education reforms. No longer will the brickie or the painter or the chef be subsidising the degrees of the dentist, the doctor or the lawyer to the extent that they currently are. With Commonwealth-supported places available in relation to a wider range of institutions and qualifications, more students will have a chance to undertake further education than ever before. So, students studying bookkeeping or computing or early childhood services will, under our reforms, for the first time, have equal access to Commonwealth support just as lawyers, doctors and architects do. This is equality of opportunity at work. They previously haven't had access to the concessional loans that university students get. We are extending it in our higher education reforms. And for the first time, we are providing financial assistance to apprentices with a new trade support loan of up to $20,000. This will assist them with the everyday costs while they complete their apprenticeship. At the moment, our higher education system means that 60% of adult Australians who will never hold a degree are paying for 60% of the degree that others will receive. Whilst the taxpayer contribution for the overall community benefit is reasonable, graduates will earn around $1 million more during their career than they would if they had not gone to university. So our reforms provide a much fairer system for those who fund and those who benefit from all forms of higher education. Ladies and gentlemen, equality in the 21st century must not be the last word. It should always be the first. But governments must pursue equality of opportunity, not equality of outcome. As the world becomes more competitive and more global, as information becomes more immediate and more comprehensive, as disruptive influences from outside our immediate community become more powerful, governments will inevitably have less influence on people's lives. In health, it's more medical research combined with new technology and better global partnerships that will deliver better health outcomes. In education, it is tomorrow's employer who is driving new standards in curriculum rather than public policy coming out of Canberra or Macquarie Street. In warfare, it is self-sufficiency and personal empowerment that will help people off welfare and into productive employment. It is not the job of government to manufacture the outcome from public policy in such a way as to ensure that every person is an equal beneficiary, notwithstanding their personal effort or their personal circumstances. Some observations of inequality are based purely on outcomes, with no regard to effort or circumstance. Everyone should know that they grow up in a country where it is possible through hard work and diligence to achieve their dreams. Our duty is to help Australians to get to the starting line while accepting that some will run faster than others. We should all have the opportunity to contribute to society to the best of our ability, rather than being subject to the lottery of our birth or the fate of our parents' wealth. In striving to achieve equality, it is not the role of government to use taxation and welfare as a tool to level the playing field. We must use the levers of government to help those who are vulnerable and frail. A just and fair society never leaves anyone behind. But a just and fair society must not seek to penalise those who aspire to be better. We must reward the lifters and discourage the leaners, provided we ensure that those most in need receive the most support. Our ambition must be for equality of opportunity rather than equality of outcome. And that is what this budget sets out to do, and that is what this government is determined to achieve. Thank you very much.
So many thanks to the Treasurer for his presentation this evening. We'll come to questions and discussion. There are a lot of people here, so I ask that you make your question or your comment brief, and of course questions or comments broadly on the topic of the talk. But before we start, many thanks to Clayton Yutz for the use of this fine facility this evening. We put this function together, as you know, in less than 2 weeks, and we're very grateful to get this facility, and we appreciate the support of the partners and staff here who've helped us do this tonight. So now we come on to questions and discussion. Thanks for an important address. It's one of a number of important addresses you've given here. But I expect you would expect that your political opponents will oppose you. I mean, that's what they do. I mean, that's what both sides of politics do. But what about some of the commentators? Because there is a view among some of the commentators that there isn't really a problem with deficits leading to debt. And then, yet you've got comments by the Treasury Secretary, by the Reserve Bank Governor, by the head of the Parliamentary Budget Office and others who say that there is. So how does someone in your position try to get a reality message through this kind of fog of opinion that says there isn't really a problem that you're trying to address?
Well, you keep at it. You keep at it. And you don't stop. And you never give up. Because when you're arguing for something that is right, at the end of the day, I think the community understands that. It's not a fiction that we have a budget problem. And there are too many people that think that because the economy is growing close to trend, that the budget's okay. But the problem is there were structural time bombs in the budget. And the structural time bombs go off over time. The mess that we were left with, $667 billion of debt, it wasn't the end of the story. We just picked the line in 10 years' time, what it would lead to. And the cost for Australia is significant. We currently pay $1 billion a month in interest on our debt. 70% of that is heading overseas because we have borrowed from people living overseas to pay our way. In 10 years' time, when you get towards $667 billion of debt, if nothing changes, that's $3 billion a month in interest, 70% of it heading overseas. Someone has to pay it. And every dollar we pay in interest is a dollar that is lost. So we still have to pay back the principal. Now, there's no Telstra to sell, there's no Qantas to sell, there's no Commonwealth Bank to sell. So you can't just shift existing pool of assets into cash and pay it off. The only way you can do it is to run a surplus. And you have to run ongoing surpluses. And sure, $10 or $20 or $30 billion surplus sounds like a lot of money. But when you've got so much debt to pay down, it takes a very long time. The second thing is, and this is where people like Ross Gittins miss the point, we are an open economy that is heavily reliant on offshore funding. Less now at the moment, but that'll change as soon as interest rates go up offshore and global money starts looking for yields. That makes us vulnerable to volatility in the global markets. And we don't fund ourselves. We never have. But if there's any lesson out of the global financial crisis, it is that we've got to reduce our exposure to offshore markets insofar as we can. Now, if we don't do it when you've got the best terms of trade in your history, when are you going to do it? The terms of trade are coming off. So the question is, when are we going to start to pay our way? And the second key point is, we are no longer competing with a weakened Europe or an America or various other places. We are competing with jurisdictions where there is very low tax, where there is a huge demand in the hands of consumers. And if we are not competitive on our tax rates and on our expenditure, then we're going to be left behind. So there are many factors at play. The final thing is, there's an assumption that we're going to continue to have economic growth. I mean, we've had more than two decades of consistent economic growth. Thank God we haven't had a recession. I remember this town, I was working as a new lawyer in this town when the recession hit in 1990. I remember it quite vividly. I hope my children never see it. I hope I never see it. But it would be a record period of time for us not to have a downturn. So let us prepare now for the downturn that may come in the future.
There's a question here. Don't stand in front of the camera.
Treasurer, this sense of entitlement that you speak of has been developing at least since the mid-70s with very little challenge. How do you propose to transform the thinking on this when you get to the point, when we've reached the point where people think that welfare is a generic form of income?
Well, it's an important point. Pensions are an income replacement, and that's why we are continuing to increase pensions. And in the last round, they increased by inflation rather than male total average weekly earnings because inflation was higher than male total average weekly earnings. So pensioners will continue to get twice a year increases, and they're going to continue to increase and significantly keep up with the increases in the cost of living. So pensions will continue as a safety net. But family payments have been an income supplement. So the worst thing you can do to a family household is to leave them without a job. I mean, it doesn't matter what the supplement is from the government. The biggest hit to a family household will be that the workers in the family lose their jobs. So everything we are focused on is driving economic growth, is driving employment, and importantly, it is about making sure that whatever we hand out from taxpayers is sustainable for the long term. And some of our changes are difficult, we know that. But if we don't move now, if we don't begin by changing part of the culture of the nation, then the cost of change in the future is going to be far greater and far more punitive, and it will come with much higher unemployment.
There's a question over there, then we come around here, okay? And then we go, yeah.
Treasurer, one of the problems with the arguments is that they are intelligent, articulate, and complicated. And when we go back to the 80s, when things did hit at that time, we had a treasurer who spoke about a recession we had to have. To what extent problem that people only understand the crisis when they're actually in the middle of it? And how do you refine the language so that it's simple enough for ordinary people to understand?
Well, I suppose the best thing you can do is try and remind people of the past. I mean, when Peter Costello introduced his 1996 budget, which was a bigger contraction, had bigger savings than this budget. When he introduced that budget, it was on the back of a number of other very difficult budgets made by Paul Keating, following on from his very difficult 1980s budget in response to the Banana Republic, or at the time of the Banana Republic comments. Now, we've had well over a decade of budgets where on budget night everyone goes down to Canberra and they're waiting to hear about the latest tax cut or the latest increase in government handouts. And sooner or later, we said that had to come to an end. And we've been saying it for years. It's not something that we invented on budget night this year. It was when the $900 checks went out, we said, sooner or later, we're all going to have to pay for it. And when the pink bats went into people's roofs, we said, sooner or later, someone's going to have to pay for it. And when you had the overpriced school halls, we kept saying, sooner or later, someone's going to have to pay for it. Well, we are paying for it now. And if we don't move now, then the cost of paying for it in the future is going to be far greater. So let us move now in a measured and considerate way. And the fact is that when it comes to government payments, overwhelmingly they go to people under $150,000 a year. Yes, they do. That's the nature of government payments. And of course, people over $150,000 are going to receive less because very few of them actually qualify for any government entitlement. So if you reduce government expenditure in welfare and health, various other areas, it's going to have an impact on people under $150,000. That's why we said that we wanted to have a deficit reduction levy. And that's why we are going into people's pockets to take some of that.
Malcolm.
Bob Hawke, when he spoke at the National Press Conference, said that to meet the economic challenges when he came to power, he had a summit. And I was wondering, since the budget's going to have a protracted passage, we're not having a summit.
Well, times are moving much faster, and the idea of a summit is unattractive given that we have to move now. And it's obvious we need to live within our means as a government. The Australian people know we have to live within our means as a government. The naysayers will pretend that there is no problem. There is a problem. And as Jared pointed out, any sensible commentator recognises that.
Right down the back in the white. Well, okay, you and then next year. Got to be brief.
Okay. Look, I'd like to congratulate the Treasurer on his moves to make a sustainable budget. However, given that the population growth rate is exceeded only by Luxembourg and Israel, almost three times the US, does the government ever desire to match the sustainable budget with a sustainable population policy?
Well, we believe that it's hugely important to have a sustainable immigration program to bring the skills in that are necessary. One of the challenges we face is an ageing population. And if you look at Japan, which is an extraordinary story, you're actually seeing the population reduce in the next 50 years. From memory, it's going from around 140 million people to around 85 million. So there's actually a reduction in the population, which means who's going to pay the bills? How are they going to sustain their quality of life? Who's going to pay for the aged care and the health care? And that's because they reject widespread, broad-based immigration, and they're certainly not reproducing. Now, we've got to get the balance right, but we've also got to make sure that we have the infrastructure that sustains a growing population. That's one of the reasons why my commitment to infrastructure and Tony Abbott's commitment as the infrastructure Prime Minister is massive. We are building the equivalent of eight Snowy Mountain schemes in the next 6 to 7 years in Australia in new infrastructure, and our asset recycling fund is actually already delivering real outcomes with announcements by the Queensland government that it's going to sell and recycle the proceeds from assets into new productive assets. Mike Baird, to his enormous credit, has done that in relation to electricity in New South Wales. Victoria, they're selling the port. Even the ACT, a Labor government, is now embracing our asset recycling fund, because we all know that we have to build a productive infrastructure that lifts the capacity of the economy over the next decade. And the only way we can afford to do that is to take money out of the lazy assets, give you, the people of Australia, the chance to buy those assets through your superannuation funds or through direct investment in the stock exchange, and at the same time take that money and build the assets that will build a new and stronger economy. We've got to reprioritise our effort, and that way we can build a more productive economy and sustain our quality of life.
We're going down the back down there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which in principle is a fantastic idea. I think my questions around that are, how do you determine what diseases your family is to cure? And also, how do you actually make those medicines, once they're discovered, broadly available to Australians?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a question about the Medical Research Fund.
It is, I think it is a landmark commitment from the government to build this fund. One of the most heartbreaking stories that you confront as a government is when researchers with enormous skills and great intelligence haven't got the capacity, you know, spend all their time filling out forms, trying to apply for the next grant because they're on the verge of a cure for some disease. Now, yesterday I was at the Bernie Banden Institute at Concord Hospital, and they are world-class at mesothelioma, dealing with mesothelioma. But in so many areas they have to go and form partnerships with other countries to get the money to commercialise it or to have clinical trials. Well, now is our chance to build the Palo Alto equivalent of medical research here in Australia for the globe. We've got the ingenuity, we've got the innovation, we've got the capacity, we've got the brains. And instead of focusing and lamenting on the passing of manufacturing and you know, some product lines that are, you know, reminders of yesterday, we should focus on the manufacturing of tomorrow. The manufacturing of tomorrow is high tech, and it is particularly in medical research. Now, we're not going to create a Google to compete with Google, but by God, we could create, you know, a dozen Cochlears or a dozen ResMeds, or we may well find the cures for dementia and Alzheimer's. And as was pointed out to me yesterday, the biggest cost to the health system is the ageing of the population. And if we can improve the quality of life through better medical care so that we delay the ageing process, which our researchers are engaged in landmark innovation in, then the savings to the health system over the medium term and long term are going to be enormous. So let's invest. Let's invest. And by asking people to contribute just $7 when they visit the doctor, $5 of that goes into the medical research fund, $2 goes to the doctor, which helps them to provide the safety net for the most needy that walk in the door. We can actually build something that is going to have a meaning and tangible outcome. Now, in relation to the allocation, that'll be in the hands of the NH and MRC, arm's length from government. We're not in the business of picking winners, but we are in the business of raising the tide so that all boats have the capacity to rise.
There's a question down there. Yeah. Yes.
Good evening, Treasurer. Helena Morrison from the Business Council of Watson's and Beauchamps. Thank you for speaking eloquently about the need to move from an era of entitlement to mutual obligation, the need to stem the tide of repatriation of profits from our economy. Does the Treasurer intend to support the move to self-help organisations to deliver services, essential public services like aged care, health care, disability care and housing, affordable housing, by
by organisations such as cooperatives and mutuals, those businesses owned by Australians, 13.5 million Australian owners.
Okay. Yes, self-help. Ultimately, it is going to be community that is the best safety net in the 21st century and beyond. It's community. Governments around the world are not stronger, they're weakened by globalisation. We should welcome that because it strengthens community. And if we strengthen community and we nurture and promote the concept of self-help in every area, then we strengthen community. And ultimately, you know, John Howard used to say it, the very best safety net in the community is your family. He's right. Some people, they haven't got families. And that's where community and government needs to step in where appropriate. But ultimately, we've got to build community and build the fabric of community, and accepting personal responsibility for one's destiny is going to be the glue that holds community together.
So we go here, then we go, Ross is down there. Yeah?
Yes, Mr. Hockey. Won't we want to be the source of Australia's wealth in the future if the mining boom ends? Our dollar, our manufacturers being knocked by the high dollar and by the low wages in many, many other countries. Mm. What would be the source of our wealth for Australia?
Well, the source of our wealth will always be our people. And it is the innovation in finding the resources and extracting resources that has helped us in recent times. It's been the R&D that we've applied in agriculture, for example, over many years. But ultimately, 70% of the Australian economy is services. And our people are our very best asset. Lifting the education standards, having world-class universities. We haven't got one university in the top 20 in the world at the moment. I mean, my Lord, I mean, we've got the best golfer in the world. We've got, you know, one of the best Grand Prix drivers in the world. We've got, we're the best in so many fields of endeavour, from sport to science to business, and yet we haven't got a university in the top 20. And it's likely, well, we won't on a sustainable basis as we see the emergence of these massive campuses in Asia. So let us compete. Let us compete. Let us deregulate our universities so they can be their best as we expect our citizens to be their best. We don't regulate the so many aspects of our lives. And there is already competition in education. You see it. You actually see it in the education system, for example, where, I mean, you know, I was in Melbourne. There were 1,200 students. There were 1,200 people at my post-budget address in Melbourne. A student got up and she said, well, I'm outraged that I might have to pay $100,000 for a university degree. Afterwards, someone pointed out to me that that student's parent was paying $35,000 a year for them to go to that school. So their parent, because of their income, their parent was choosing that they go to a private university in order, in the view of the parent and maybe the child, to get a better quality education. And the public education system is in part left behind. So what are we going to do about it? Are we just going to let that continue, or are we going to try and lift the opportunity for everyone? And that is exactly what we are doing. So our future wealth comes from our people. The more we invest in our people and in their skills, and the more we give them the freedom to be better, then the better the opportunity for everyone and the more wealth we will create over time.
Ross?
Treasurer, we've got the Australians have a great problem that we've had 25 years of life expectancy in the last century. But the difficult problem is that it's totally unfunded. So then the Labor and the Coalition together have increased the entitlement age of the pension from 65 to by 2030, 70. So a 5-year response to a 25-year problem. And we've had compulsory superannuation now for 24 years. So I think that some of us were disappointed to find that still 80% of Australians are retiring with at least a part pension after 24 years of superannuation. Life expectancy will continue, presumably, hopefully, to increase. Are settings on superannuation are going to allow that number of 80% aligners to fall? Or are we just going to permanently see a majority of the Australian population relying on government for retirement income?
Well, you are going on current trends. It will continue to be around 80% of Australians that are on an age pension by 2050. So the ratio doesn't change. It's simply the change between people on full pension decreases and people on part pension increases because of superannuation. So our changes make the pension system far more sustainable. It is somewhat frustrating that the Labor Party recognised this when they're in the government. They increased the retirement, the eligibility age for the pension from 65 to 67 by 2023. So they increased it, recognising that there are pressures. Now, we recognise that you've got to continue that trend, so we said, OK, we're going to increase it to 70 in 2035. Lots of notice. It's going to affect you, but it's not going to affect most of the people here. The fact is, Labor's saying, no, we don't want to do this. They're not offering an alternative. They're just saying, no, we don't want to continue with that important reform. And we should celebrate the fact that we're living longer. But we also owe it to future generations to make sure they have a decent quality of life. Because you can't keep maintaining a system based on yesterday's presumptions and expect that it's going to be sustainable in the future when everything changes. So we've got to start building for the future now. And that is exactly the case with the pension and retirement income system. Now, there's been lots of commentary from people saying, well, you should be changing superannuation. Well, we said we weren't going to change superannuation in this term of government. And we're keeping our promise. So even some on our own side who argue that we should change superannuation, they want us now to break promises. They want us to keep them, then they want us to break them. They've got to make up their minds. And we've said we're not changing the pension, we're not changing superannuation this term, but we have flagged, given good notice, that changes to the age pension, which take effect after the next election. We could have just gone the next election, not said anything about it, and then ripped it in. But we form the view it is better to be upfront and provide certainty and stability. And that's exactly what we're doing. And it means that there is going to be no decrease in pensions for those who are eligible. But the pension will be on a more sustainable basis, on a more sustainable footing over time.
There's a question down the back there. We've got to be very quick. Yes? Yes, Quan. Yeah. It's got to be quick.
Treasurer, you've implied that there should be a safety net and also no limit on opportunity and that the high personal income tax rate in Australia is providing the investment capital or venture capital that there's a massive exit on Australia's talent people and seeds.
Okay, you've got to get to the point, okay?
The question is that I commend you on reducing government spending, and that is what we need, but don't we also need growth? Don't we need to reduce personal income tax rates simultaneously?
Okay, suggested so do you need to reduce personal income tax rates simultaneously with increasing growth?
Right. Well, over time, there's going to be increasing pressure to reduce personal income tax. Not just because us holding on to fiscal drag is going to detract from growth. That's obvious. And we've said we've built into the budget over 10 years tax cuts so that we have put a limit on income tax collections because our view and the advice provided is that over a certain point, if income taxes get higher and higher for the average worker, then it detracts from economic growth. We don't want that. But competition's going to come from offshore. Wait until one day the Europeans finally get their act together. All right? I mean, we're in the calm waters at the moment, if you like. The Americans are starting to emerge. The American economy is starting to emerge. China's running at somewhere between 7 and 7.5% growth. Japan's an interesting case study. India's a bit in the doldrums. Indonesia's going through elections. This will all change. America will recover. America will recover, and it will be stronger and stronger. And Europe will recover, and it will be stronger. And Japan at some point will have to recover. And many other emerging economies in Asia will provide us with competition. So let us be prepared today. Let us start preparing now. And that's why the budget is focused on the long-term issues facing us, including the issues about taxation. We've said we're going to have a taxation white paper and take policy change to the next election. And we will do that. Not because we're looking for new and exciting sources of revenue, no. We're actually looking for a competitive taxation system. And when the UK goes to 21% company tax, and companies like BHP and Rio, who are amongst our very largest company taxpayers, they are a massive part of our revenue. When they start looking at 21% company tax in the UK, well, this is part of the challenge that we face. And we've got to be ready for that challenge and be prepared to compete.
Second last question, going to be very brief here. Yeah.
Treasury, you've given us, in my view, a pretty clear and reasonable description of what the problem is. Is there disagreement? Why is there so much disagreement about what the problem is, which leads and breeds so many different solutions to fixing it? I can't understand that.
Well, there's no doubt that our critics have been energised by the budget, and they see it as an opportunity to rebuild their base. But it's based on the false premise that nothing's wrong. There are no problems. And any sensible commentator and anyone with an ounce of understanding of the true state of the budget and anyone that is looking forward rather than in the rearview mirror would recognise that we must act now. We must act now. So we have laid down a budget that is about the future. And you have to earn growth. You have to earn growth. Some people would argue you can just sit back and it'll come. Well, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. We are in a very competitive world and it's going to become more competitive. We've got to be ready. And that's exactly what our budget does, and that is what our economic action strategy is about. It's about a number of steps, and the budget's part of that.
That's. I think we'll leave it there. That's. We're right on time. There are many more questions here. We can't take everyone, but we've taken over half an hour of questions tonight and discussion. So I would just like to say thanks for coming along tonight and giving a very unequivocal address, readily understandable, with a very strong message. And we're very pleased that you gave it at the Sydney Institute. I'm sure, like your previous talks here, this speech will also last a long time, but it's particularly important in the present time, but it will go beyond that. So we're very grateful you came along to spare your time tonight at a busy time of your life. So well done, and we'll see you again in the future.
Thanks, sir.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.